Today, we're bringing you an adventure in art history on the return of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. There'll be a crackling fire in the background. We have Bach playing right now, just trying to bring a little bit of class to this podcast. Our journey is with Gabrielle Reese. She's an art historian living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And as you may know, Santa Fe is hardly lacking in any art or history. There's also the great food, and don't forget the great opera. But this is not an ad for Santa Fe. Maybe someday. We'll see. But where was I? Okay, so Gabrielle Palmer, her journey begins just before World War II, and she's living in Europe, and that's really the perfect place for a young person to build a foundation in art history.
I think with a European background, you tend always to go to museums. I was taken a lot to museums, and so I was taken by my mother to a church where they sang, you know, when they're deep, deep. And I fell just absolutely in love with all that kind of thing. And with
So what does a newly minted PhD do? A PhD in art history? Well, she goes to Spain and meets the king. And instead of going to the classroom, she stays in Santa Fe. And in between those worldly travels, she embarks on projects that are preserving the Spanish influence in New Mexico. The restoration of a 300-year-old church, along with writing extensively about the Camino Real. That's the road that came up from Mexico City into the road the Spanish used to trek from Mexico City into Santa Fe. What's most remarkable about this journey is that it hasn't ended. It began in the 1930s, and now it continues as Dr. Palmer explores the art of the Spanish Catholic Church. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is made by me, Ted Conte Jr. Mountain Geek Productions is my little outfit here that I guess I've put together. Outfit. It's just me. Sometimes the dog comes downstairs. Anyways, thanks for listening and downloading us. Really appreciate it, downloading us. And now I'm talking in the third person. I guess us would be my guests and I, Gabrielle Palmer. Gabrielle and I have known each other since the 1980s. She's an old friend of my mom's. And I got to thank my mom for helping me put this together. She also is the other voice in the background. And thanks again, Mom, for helping me out. Well, let's get on with the show here, shall we? Dr. Gabrielle Palmer on Piled High and Deep, the podcast.
You had said it, that what you were going to talk about was what somebody who had an advanced degree
yes.
was doing.
It really is. I want to hear about all your journey. I want to know about your growing up. What was it in your upbringing that led you to your path of getting a PhD? What adventures did you have early on that maybe laid the groundwork for the interest that you ultimately built upon for your PhD?
Let me tell you something that has happened to me in the last 2 weeks. And it's quite remarkable. Probably not the latter part of it, the last 2 weeks. I think the thing was set for a long, long time. And it is that I have a couple of times had an experience with the person who will speak about rebirth and the other one, resurrection. And I found myself one time when I was I have to talk a little bit about personal things. My mother and my stepdaughter, who were my closest people, were killed. One was killed and the other committed suicide. And it was it at this part I was really very sad. I mean more than sad. But I ended up at around Christmas Easter at the church up here, which I never went to. I don't like the church particularly, but I went there. And I found myself standing in the back of the church, really sorrowful. And next to me was one of those strange wooden expressions of Christ. And I found myself singing, or somebody said or something, is there such a thing as resurrection, or is it really all rebirth? And I didn't know why I said that or what I – it was – and in the following years, I found that theme of rebirth coming back and back and back again. And so I said, maybe it's happening to me, whatever. And I have had the idea always behind and behind what they thought. And just recently, it's come up, and in ways that it seems to tell me that it is. And so it's been a very changing couple of days for me, a couple of weeks, or something like that, because it seems to be saying, actually, that's the truth, and you've experienced it and are going to experience it again. And I've had that. That thing happened to me.
How long have you lived in Santa Fe?
A long time now, 30 years.
What brought you here?
I was living in Europe with my husband, and we decided not to to follow on together. So we came back. He went his way. And I came to Santa Fe because I had developed a real dislike for big cities. And I'd, before this, I had lived in San Francisco and in Los Angeles and in Rome and things like that, and I really couldn't stand it. And I remembered that there was this town that somebody had brought to me. Her father owned one of the huge sheep ranches up north, and so I was invited in high school to come and spend the summer here. And I then remembered afterwards that it was quite charming and came here to get away from big cities.
Santa Fe was a small town then.
Yes, it was. It really was.
It's a small city today.
Yeah.
What the way I like these conversations is to bounce around, and we got, you know, that's the way conversations are. What was it about your early time here in Santa Fe? What was it that drove you here? In terms of, you knew you wanted to come to Santa Fe, but what did you find that interested you here?
How can you say it? People of different nationalities, and that since I was born and in Europe, I was born in Africa, and raised in Europe. And had been in places where there were people. And that's really what I like, too.
Santa Fe is mostly Hispanic, Native American, with some white folks.
Yes.
Around here. You were born in North Africa.
I was born in Algiers.
What took your family to Algiers?
My father and mother met in Florence. My father was Italian. And my mother was American, and they fell in love and were married. And then my father was assigned, he was in Lloyd's of London, he was assigned a job there, and that's why they went.
Brothers and sisters?
Excuse me?
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No.
No? An only child?
Yes.
In Algiers?
Yeah.
The world was your oyster. How long did you live there?
We didn't stay there very long.
You didn't?
No, 6 months, and then we went over very wonderfully to the south of France, and so I was raised in Gun.
So do you think of yourself as English, American, French? When you think of yourself as a nationality, do you think of yourself as a nationality?
You know, not very much. I don't think of myself as American. I think of myself as partly American. I've lived many years in America, but I've never shaken the French and the living in different countries and speaking different languages. I, That's really who I am.
How many languages? How many different languages can you hold a reasonable conversation in?
Italian, French, English, Spanish. Oh, that's about it.
Okay. I'm guessing your father and maybe even your mother, strong educational backgrounds for both of them?
Neither. My father was raised in Lausanne, Switzerland, and his mother forced him to go into a convent, and he hated and despised it.
Okay.
and got rid of it as soon as possible and started out in the business
But he worked in the insurance world.
He stayed in that kind of world, business world. And my mother was she was very beautiful, but born and raised in upper class San Francisco, with all of its snobbishness. Her family had come across some of the people who were the founders of San Francisco, so had tons of money, and so she was raised beautiful, rich, and snobbish. And she never worked a dime in her life.
Do you know the story of how your parents met?
I think at dinner time, because my aunt was also married to an Italian. I think they met at dinner in my grandparents' house, great-grandparents' house.
Yes. In Italy?
Yes.
How long? What was school like for you? Did you enjoy going to school?
Yeah. Yeah, it was always easy for me.
Okay.
Very easy.
And was that all in France, or did you find yourself moving around in how many schools did you attend?
No, once we were in France, we stayed. For 8 years.
Okay.
And I went to a private school and had an English accent because the people who taught there were English. So I was raised with an English accent.
What about high school?
By that time, by high school, we had come because the war was coming and my parents were not getting along. And so my mother and I came across the Pacific, the Atlantic, and because of the threat of the war.
Your father stayed in Europe?
For a while, and then he came over. But he didn't stay very long with us. He abandoned us.
Was that then living in San Francisco?
Yes.
So 1940s, you're in San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's finishing high school. Where did you go to college?
First of all, my grandmother died. Oh. And my mother took me and her, of course, to Los Angeles to get away from the family. And she didn't really like San Francisco at all. So we ended up in the 1940s in Los Angeles. And I went to high school there, first in a public school, and then again in a private school.
What subjects do you remember liking in high school? Was there anything that you can look upon that was a seed for?
No.
Where did you go to college?
Why did I go to college?
No, where did you go to college?
Where did you go into college? I went for one brief semester at UC Berkeley. And then there was a long time when I went to work. And then I came back. I don't have the memory of the next one. It was here in America, and I think it was in Los Angeles. I can't quite remember it right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did you ultimately get your Bachelor's of Arts degree?
I think I had come back after being married and then divorced. I went down for one semester here just to see what it was, thinking I would never do it. And I ran in with, let's get this straight. I went to to the art department, not history of art department, and they let me be in how do you call that?
In that.
Yeah, and so that was where I was starting, and the thing that was interesting was that the first professor that I had was a terrible martinet, and I stood up to him, and so I got the first time it was easy for me. He challenged me a lot, and so I bested him all the time. One time he was giving out a very difficult thing that you had to do in Italian, and I gave it all to him in Italian. But he was the one that challenged me to have discipline and to acknowledge that you're with one subject. Before, I had just kind of wandered vaguely around from wherever I wanted.
What was it about the history of art that grabbed you?
I think with a European background, you tend always to go to museums. I was taken a lot to museums. And I remember there was in Cannes, where we were, they call them white Russians. They were expatriate Russians. So I was taken by my mother to a church where they sang, you know, when they're deep, deep. And I fell just absolutely in love with all that kind of thing and with art.
What made you decide to get your PhD? Because I'm guessing it was late 40s, early 50s.
Yes. After I got that thing with the professor that I was telling you was very harsh, I was here. I bought this house, and I was in the garden in the summertime, and I was handed an envelope from the university, and I didn't know what that would possibly be. And it turned out that this guy had put my name in for a fellowship without my knowledge. And so I was being offered what later turned on all of my work in classes with that were paid for. From then on, I got scholarships.
Now, what university did you get your PhD from?
UNM.
UNM, down in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
Did you make the trek from Santa Fe down to Albuquerque a couple of days a week?
Yeah, every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
It was before they had the nice little train.
Yeah.
What was it that you studied that led to your dissertation?
I was introduced to a well-known person at that time named Uli Bari. And we just happened to cross paths. He was with a friend of mine, and we crossed paths. And he told me that he was he'd just been given the directorship of a new center to be in Ecuador, and he was going to represent the university. And with one thing and another, he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I just completed all of my requirements for an advanced degree, and that's all." He said, "Why don't you come to Ecuador?" And that's why I got to Ecuador. I thought it was so interesting to be in a country so far away. And I wasn't ever afraid of traveling because of my background. And so he helped me get to Ecuador. And that's where I spent and did my book and did my dissertation and everything.
Had your worldly travels just kept you in Europe? Up until that point, had you been down to the Americas at all?
Not at all.
Not at all.
No. And I was. I was 8 years old when I came to this country. So I wasn't walking around by myself.
After high school, You had a little bit of college. You said you were married for a short time. Did you find yourself staying in the States at that point, or were you going back to Europe?
I would have gone back to Europe except for the war.
Right. Yeah. So tell me about your work in Ecuador.
I just went there for one semester. And I found when I got there that nobody had done anything at all in research. And it was quite fascinating. The native population and then the fancy people who were very rich and had haciendas. So I was able to go by myself and do what I wanted. And when I came back and had my first impression, I guess, of... I went to see the president of the university, and I told him, you know, I'd so many doors had been opened to me. Instead of just cutting me off at where I was, let me go ahead and get a better degree. And that's when they gave me the possibility of taking advanced degree.
You're getting your PhD.
Yeah.
The work that you did in Ecuador became your dissertation. Mm-hmm. What was that dissertation about?
Dissertation is exactly what it was, a book. They printed my dissertation as a book. And so it was a kind of an overview of all of Ecuador historically. And I had, by that time, been to Spain and studied the Spanish origin of some of the statuary, religious statuary, which was put inside the Catholic churches that the Spanish built. And that was what I studied. I went to Spain and I looked at the origin, because there were the statues that I studied, nobody knew how old they were or what they were. Only by going to Spain and making a composition of, yes, a change. Yeah, right. That I was able to, and that's what I did. I took not only the history in this book, but took the constitution of the images themselves and what they might represent and that kind of thing. So it was pretty original in that respect. And in the other respect, it was historic.
Were you looking... So you were just looking at the Catholic iconography that was present in the Spanish-built churches, and so you went to Spain to build upon that to get a sense as to the impact or what was used then in Ecuador.
Yes.
Did you do any work with native people down in Ecuador? No. So it was merely just taking a look at the influence of the Spanish and the Spanish Catholic Church,
right,
in Ecuador.
Right.
You yourself, were you raised religious at all?
And was not religious by character.
How has religion played a role outside of academia for you? Have you found, for lack of a better term, found religion?
Less.
Even less so, yes.
I was in charge of the restoration of the Guadalupe Church.
Yep, we're going to talk about that, yeah, here in a minute. So you finish your dissertation, so you've got your PhD now behind your name. What are you going to do next?
Oh, I went for subject of the Camino Real, because that ran very close to where that church is. I was interested in that, and so I worked with and helped the whole history of trying to find the Camino Real, and I ended up by going over to Spain. I'd been invited to Spain to give a talk about Ecuador. And so they, at that moment, they introduced me to a man named, I've forgotten, and and he was the Count of so-and-so. Of the original, a real person who was could celebrate his what was his called? The guy that came up the Camino Real.
Oh.
Oñate.
Oñate.
He was a cousin, or 17th cousin, or whatever. He came up to me when I was talking and said, I'm so-and-so. So when I came back to the United States, I said, you've got this guy. You better bring him over here and introduce him, you know. And so he did. And that was the way I got into Spain. Then I put together a group that talked about the Camino Real, and we began for the fifth. It was a Columbus anniversary or something like that. So they did they took us and a lot of other exhibits over to Spain, where we were introduced to the king and had a party and had an exhibit. And so that was another step in taking it to acknowledgement. Yeah, so that's what I did after.
How much time do you spend trying to look at the influence of what the Catholic Church is trying to put on the native culture in Ecuador?
It's a very narrow kind of thing. It's not a general a cultural thing, because you go over there, and it's in the 18th century the Spanish have their the highest moment of making these religious statues. And so you can only go to a little bit to what happened in Spain, but didn't have much influence in what was happening in Ecuador. Ecuador was a very, nothing much was going on. I mean, they accepted what Spain gave them, put them in place, prayed to them. It didn't influence their own art, the beginning of themselves making these very same images, but not until there'd been an amelioration of the demands of the hierarchies, where they were forced to be Catholic. They were forced to be that kind of thing. So when that began to be a little bit mitigated, when a little bit more freedom was allowed people here, and things were changing a little bit here, that was when you began to see a slight change in the art that was inspired by Spain and now taken over by local people. Then this is my whole thesis. Nobody saw them. They went and looked at them, and they said, they're religious statues. That's all there is to them. She's got her hand up high or something like that. I took and am taking a deeper look at it, because I found and wrote in my book at the last chapter that if you look carefully, really carefully, at these different statues, and even though you don't know whether or not they are how they fit in the I can't think. One is this year, and that is
in the
that.
Timeline.
You don't have any knowledge of it, but I found that when you really looked at them, and you looked first at the Spanish and then later at the Ecuadorians, what had happened was that they didn't really change them, except this way, that they started at the Spanish were very
arms crossed in front of the chest.
Yeah.
Okay,
and over a period of some hundred years, they started to open up. Until
submissive.
But it,
The Virgin was submissive.
Yeah, more than submissive. It was, they loved that, those, that image. But it was very, very close to their bodies and very constrained.
Now was that from, was that a change in the Spanish art, or was that a change in what the Ecuadorians the were Ecuadorian. Doing? So as the Ecuadorians were becoming, they had been forced into the church, but they were taking it in. The art that they were then producing, the religious iconography that they were doing, went from the closed arms to a more open, so almost like opening themselves to this.
Not almost, opening.
It was opening themselves, okay.
It was opening themselves. There was more of an equality. And then at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, you find that there's a closeness there, and you find an openness there. So la plebe is not only this gesture, but the common people now begin to enter, to go to. So I had an exhibit once, and I said vamos todos a Belén. In other words, it wasn't the fancy person only. And
it was the common people.
And the common people who entered into the life of the entire place.
Did you ever go into the classroom to teach?
No.
You found yourself as a subject matter expert. Mm-hmm. Did you ever leave your studies in Ecuador to go start looking at other cultural iconography? That's going to be a hard word. I should just stop saying it. Outside of the Catholic, or did you stay within Catholicism?
Because I had other things to do. I had to get a job, and I did the restoration of the Guadalupe Church, so I couldn't follow that strain.
Okay, so let's talk about the Guadalupe Church here in downtown Santa Fe. When was it built originally? About mid-1700s?
I'm trying to think if it's earlier or not. At least 1700s.
Because the Spanish come up from Mexico into New Mexico.
Yes.
Late 1600s?
Yeah, right around there.
Okay. So they found Santa Fe. I mean, they establish Santa Fe. There's a couple of churches that are very famous here in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
There's, what's the church that has the staircase?
That's the one right down here.
Loretto.
I've forgotten.
Right. What was it about the Guadalupe Church that interested you?
A friend. It had been built earlier, but many changes, and in this particular change model that they had then, they had stained glass and things that were not appropriate. None of it was appropriate for
the church built in that period.
In adobe, it was crazy. And these had all been, for 16 years, that church, nobody did anything with them, except they did do something with the inside painting. But all of these things had been broken in. And I had a friend who lived up here, and we kept saying, what a shame. And she kept saying to me, why don't you do something? And so I've forgotten that it was a series of circumstances. I found myself down with the Archbishop saying, you know, I could do something about that. So he gave me permission, and it made a lot of people mad. And almost by mistake, I got a grant because somebody in that winter had handed me a piece of paper and had said, you want, here's a grant paper. And they gave it to me. It was a HUD grant. And I filled it out. And that spring, somebody said to me, oh, congratulations, you got your grant. And I said, what grant? And so that began it. That it was a bunch of moments that I can't explain at all.
What year is this? Do you remember?
Oh, I'm very bad on. You can. You might have been all here. Here's all the dates. Mm-hmm. This is what we did when we came, and that my good luck was that I knew the person who owned the newspaper here, and his wife was social. You know, she had a lot of parties and things like that.
So this is about 1975.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
Did anybody ever question why is somebody who's not a part of the Catholic Church?
You bet.
Was there a lot of pushback because of that?
You know, I think that they thought, yes. There were a couple of people who were in the church itself. They were mad as hell and still are. But there was nothing they could do because the archbishop had given me permission. He was the one who gave me permission. And number two, I'd gotten a grant. So there was nothing they could do. You know, there was nobody except me. So that's, it was, as I say, a bunch of mistakes. And then when this very famous architect, the wife of this man who owned the paper, was with me, then she Nat Owings, who was a very famous and very rich architect, and he came in and said, "I'll help you do it at no charge. I'd like to do it." So nobody was against getting rid of him, you know. And he was really the one. You know, I was the one who was good at getting grants and doing the work. He was the one who had the foresight of how to do it. We scraped all of the old paint and everything and went back to the adobe. He went back, if you can look in the interior, to the original kind of look of the interior, and without him, because at one point, Father Leo, who was absolutely still hates me, had decided that he was going to put a fence around it, around the whole of the church, and he put a picket fence, a New England thick picket fence. Picket. And I said, even I know that. This is not going to happen.
The book that you handed me is The Guadalupe Historic Foundation, How a Secular Nonprofit Organization Saved Santa Fe's Most Religious Site.
They dedicated it to me and said something about it.
Yes, the inscription from the author thanking you for.
No, it's dedicated to me on the beginning. So I don't know why.
How long did that project last?
3 years.
3 years. And what was your day? Can you remember what a week would look like? Were you in the building every day?
Yes, I was.
So the dedication is, this book is dedicated to Spanish colonial historian Gabriel Palmer, who had the foresight, wisdom, and energy to lead the efforts to save the Santuario de Guadalupe when others wanted to tear it down and put up a parking lot. The Guadalupe Historical Foundation was the result, and we are forever grateful for all who followed her, staff, members, volunteers, and donors who kept the dream alive over years and saved the Santuario de Guadalupe. When you drive past that building, what do you think to yourself?
I don't. I haven't. You know, fallen into the idea of pride or anything like that, because. The the people down there, the religious people, were not so nasty deliberately, but they ignored me. They never spoke of it. It was okay with me, but I don't have any great moment of pride or anything like that. But I did it. So that's the only thing that I like to remember.
Yes, the satisfaction of a job well done. But you came to this project as a historian to, well, we just kind of talked about it. Is it a resurrection or was it a rebirth of a building?
That's one of the things that sticks with me. I think I started at that moment to think in other terms and beyond the religious, because rebirth can be of any kind and it can be multifaceted. And so I think that's what began in my head and may have been the secret reason for doing what I did. And I think I would think in because of the things that have happened to me recently, I would think that the idea of rebirth as the renewal of the individual is what somebody was pushing me to do.
What did you do after the church project?
What did I do after the church project? I went over to Europe. I wrote that book. I did something else.
You worked on the Camino de Real to get the museum.
Yes, that's right. And so I did a couple of other
things.
What
was the Camino de Real?
The Camino Real that goes down, it's what the Spanish came up on and what we go down on.
Okay.
It's a road.
Yeah. The trail.
What was special about that project?
Well, by that time I had been over to Spain and met the king, sat next to him, and been drawn into that a little bit more. And then I wrote my book, and then I kind of drifted off into things of my own.
You have four books that you've written?
Yeah. I also worked with BLM. When the BLM guy was first there, I went up and invited him for lunch. Petrified, but invited him for lunch. We became good friends, and I wrote and helped design other books with BLM.
And what were those books? Were those, again, art history? No.
No, they were mostly about the Camino Real. Or in some cases, they were not books by individuals, but they were essays, groups of essays, so they could be of anything. That they down on going down here to the Mexico border.
What has kept your brain alive these last 20 years, in terms of?
Who knows that it's alive?
What
you're leaving yourself in there for
what has kept you stimulated or curious?
I think I've begun to think about different things, particularly at the beginning, going back to the first time that I was at UNM when I was 19 years old or something like that, the professor hated me because I was younger than he was or something like that, and so I would argue with him, and I'm sure he was right, quite correct to be angry with me. But the thing was that at the last moment, or the last day, when we came, when it wasn't a very large class, when Art 101, and we were supposed to sketch things. Well, I never could, you know, so that's why I got so mad with me. And the last day that we were there, we were all of the class was confronted with a bunch of designs, and we were supposed to tell which ones we liked and which ones were the best. And the other people all came in. They stood there and gave their opinion. They were all very conventional. But I got fascinated by one that I saw that was ugly. I thought it was really ugly. But when I looked at it, I saw out of my eyes there were three gray lines that made it that rebalanced. So I told the professor that I liked that one better. He was furious. He was absolutely mad as hell. But that was the point of a turning for me, when I could say the one that I liked, and some mysterious force that I never knew, which has been the kind of spiritual one that has grown in my life, had put three lines on it and made it balance.
Where do you get balance from three lines?
They did it. I don't know.
Three isn't a balance. Well, maybe on a footstool.
No, three. It was already. It was. I had. Everybody else had liked it, a design.
Well, but you liked the one that the professor.
But I liked the one. They said was awful, and it was. You know, so from that moment on, you know, I was rebellious, and from that moment on, somehow. These three lines, where'd they come from? Did they come from my mind? Did somebody else put them there? And that introduced me to spirituality.
It introduced you to spirituality. How has that driven you in the work that you've done? Do you said you're not religious, but you're spiritual. What's the separation between those two? What's the difference there?
Well, one, I don't worship anything, anybody, or anything, but those things that come out of nowhere seem to me to be mysterious. And I think the only philosophy that I have is that everything is mysterious, and mystery is what belongs to it. We shouldn't scramble around too damn much trying to find out what it is, because we'll never know.
Or we'll just come up with more questions to ask.
Come up with more questions or more, you know. So I'm sorry, sometimes my...
more excuses.
Yeah. but when everybody has all of these things that go around the block, all of these, what do you call them when it's... I don't say, but yeah, and they say, well, we know this, or we know the name of this. Good luck.
What have your last two books been about?
I think they were just those essays.
Just those essays. And they were essays about the Camino?
The trail down the road, or the... the help of, you know, that kind of thing.
And what is it that you're working on now?
I have gone back, and this is for quite a long time, revisited the thing that I did and asked that very question. What is that mysterious thing? What is your relationship to it? And why did they open themselves up?
And have you come up with some semblance of a theory, at least? Not necessarily an answer, but a theory? Is it possible that this native culture that had a religious practice thrust upon them that is very closed, just felt that they needed something more open, and is that why they changed the iconography?
No, I think it was an internal thing. I think they just picked it up. I think it was native to probably more things than more people than we know. And the idea that we may have opposed to linear time, cyclical time, which women are more closely allied to, and that was it. It was like nature more than culture, and that's where it lies.
You could have left Santa Fe a long time ago. It's cold here today. You know, it's snowed. It doesn't snow very much here in Santa Fe, but it is cold. What has kept you here?
This house, probably. It's a nice house.
What is? Tell me about the house. What's special about it?
I really like it. I really like it. It represents a lot of things to me, and I can come and go when I want to. And I think it represents who I am. I like the spatial part about it, and I like everything about it. And I can work here, and with my ideas, I don't have to be bothered by anything anymore. And I think it's where I am and who I am.
When was the last time you traveled? When was the last time? When were you in Europe the last time?
Well, I've had the misfortune that I've gotten sick a lot. And for the last 2-3 years, spent a hell of a lot of time with doctors. And so that answer is, I don't know why I did that. I don't know. I've known more doctors. So it's held me back. And I haven't traveled. And I haven't always thought, because sometimes my head is just some damn doctor or not. But now I'm coming back.
So how old is the house?
Probably about... I went down into the basement one time and found a newspaper, and it looked like from the last World War, maybe in the 50s.
Late 40s.
Yeah.
So this house was built sometime in the 40s.
Yes, and I've done a lot of rear work on it, yeah.
What would 16 or 17-year-old Gabriella think of her life in 2018?
I think I made a lot of mistakes. A lot of mistakes. I think I'm probably more generous and incautious now than I was before. And I think I'm willing to say it's been. There's nothing I can do about it. And I'm particularly now, I'm really glad to be able to wake up and see it. I can look better. I can look just enjoy and appreciate what's around me and what's happened to me, and not expect anything more.
What would you say to somebody thinking, well, tell me about what you've learned in this career of art history? Is it... let me back up. Had you had the chance to go to stay in academics and to be in a classroom, was that ever an interest to you?
No. I have taught, but occasionally, and people have asked me to teach, but I'm not a good teacher.
What makes then that PhD that you obtained, what was the value that you were able to build upon that?
I can be very snotty sometimes.
Did it provide So back in the 70s, as you're putting together this foundation for the church, do you think it helped that you had those three little letters behind your name?
You bet. And particularly in places like Mexico, where that's everything. You say doctora and everybody, you know, genuflex or something like that. It always is to some degree. You can get stuff because of it.
When you think back to this journey that you've had, and it's not over yet, because you're in the middle of, you still have another book that you're near completing.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we talked, when we saw you in July, you were talking that
dragging, but
it was dragging, but you're getting there to the end.
Yeah.
What are you going to do after that?
Great, good God, I'll be too old to know.
Yeah, do you
maybe
relax?
Just fly. I think what I've been thinking the last 2 days, if there is such a thing as rebirth, it may be that from the things that have happened to me, that you cross over at some point and you leave the old self behind and you start working on the new self. And I think that might be possible. I think it's very possible. And if I'm stuck doing that, I've been across the bridge, so I'm stuck with the next life.
What is it about your journey for your PhD that maybe some wisdom that you would like to impart on the world that maybe isn't, you know, in your books or you can share about your adventure?
I think the only thing that I've thought about recently is the capacity now to have slightly way of thinking of things. And I was writing about it this morning. I think, well, I can give you an example. There's a friend of mine here in town. One day I went in, she and her husband own a repair service. I walked in, and I hope I can say something about this. And I stood in front of her desk. She was typing, I was standing in front of her desk. And I had been reading about and thinking about the famous Mona Lisa, and the thing that they always ask about it was the person that painted the Mona Lisa looking at a live image, not image, live person, and painting from that. Was he doing it from a sketch or something like that? What was he doing? I was looking at Annette. And I just, you know how you do sometimes, your gaze goes on somebody. And she must have been a beautiful young woman because she's such a handsome, maybe 50s. And I was looking at her, and I saw an intermediate image. I saw something which was not somebody copying it because they saw it was not something which they were caused to. It was an intermediate thing in which I knew, I don't know how I knew, the person who saw it in this case, Da Vinci, saw it with different eyes. They're not these eyes, and they're not any kind of eyes. They're eyes for your for the very act of seeing. And it wasn't, oh, I wonder if it's blue here. Oh, they have to be here. It was something completely original, and it got to who she was. She was that thing, and she didn't know, and I didn't know, but it was a difference. And it happened to me this morning that I saw something like that. And what you see is the continuity itself. You see the person for who they are. You see the essence, and you're not looking at them, and you're not thinking about them. It just comes to you, and it's the act of being. It's not the act of looking. It's the act of being, because somehow at some moment of grace, you've been shown what that person's essence is, not who they are, but their absolute essence, and you've seen it for one glimpse. You know, and I don't think I've never read in any of the books that I've written that you see that intermediate stage. I don't think too many people know about it. And I think it what makes the great engineer, the great mathematician, it's that knowing the essence of something. I think it really is. And I told you I was excited for the last 2 or 3 days. I said, if you can see even for an instance anything that you have to see, a tree, whatever, in its essence, you see something that is life itself. I don't think it's any of these things we've been talking about.
Have you found that before in art?
That's the first time I've ever done that. And it isn't anything that you do. It does. It's its own thing. It's not asking for it. It's not expecting it. It's, ooh.
Yeah. It was like getting hit with a bucket of cold water.
It was very calm, actually. It was not...
It was just a very calming...
It was just as if you were looking at me and you saw me differently. That's all. But it's so impressive, and you think about it afterwards. You know, think, oh my God, what did I do? What did I see? How can you do that? And that is about the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Dr. Palmer, thank you very much for your time.
You're
this
welcome.
This was wonderful.
You're welcome. It's awfully nice of you to be here.
Well, thank you for your time, and the crackling of the fire was most wonderful, and thanks to my mom for helping out as well. Thanks, Mom.
Thank you. You're more than welcome. I'm very flattered, but it's been fun.
Thank you again to Dr. Gabrielle Palmer. An amazing adventure, an amazing woman. I look forward to seeing her again in Santa Fe very soon. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, we're going to be back. I've already got some interviews lined up and in the can, so don't go away. Keep checking us out. Subscribe. We'll have another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, keep shoveling.